Welcome back, everybody. This is the Midweek Minute Edition of the Man Cave Caucus podcast. Finally, I've got a little bit of time to do a midweek edition. It's been so busy and just swamped lately. So back on the Midweek Minute Edition. And this week, we have a special guest, which is the representative from... What district is your district?
125.
125. Okay, so District 125, Representative Dane Deal. Or... as I like to say sometimes, the real deal.
Well, I'll accept that for sure.
So it's good to have you with us, Dane. And before we get into the topic today, I always like to just introduce our guests a little bit to the audience and tell us a little bit about yourself, like your district, why you ran for office, maybe a little bit about your family, whatever. Give us just a couple minutes on who you are.
Well, you know, we're good at that field. I like to, going back on clarification for District 125, halfway between Kansas City and Joplin. I use those two markers because most everybody knows where those cities are.
Yeah.
Serve almost three counties, Bates, Vernon, and half of Cedar, I would say, is accurate in size there. Farmer by trade, day in, day out, making a living off the row and the hoof, diversified cattle, row crop. Live it day in, day out. Fifth generation, I guess, is what I would say by trade. Still love it. Raising a family, doing it. Two young kids, 2 and 1.
Cool.
Days, you know, days can be long.
That's a job right there.
Days can be long. I have a wife that's a saint named Erica. She works in at Farm Credit Services, so she deals with the ag sector day in, day out, also in Nevada. But it's challenging outside. I would say that path of agriculture led me to be here. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't working with commodity groups, organizations, having a great relationship with our former representative. And the spillover of my love for ag allowed me to follow other broader policy. Always been, you know, a lifelong Republican. I can remember going with my grandparents at a younger age to many of the meetings and always being involved, but actually taking an interest in what other things were going on in Jefferson City. So that's kind of the path. Had a lot of help, you know, met a lot of good people along the way, and ultimately knew I'm always going to go home after politics. And I think that keeps my compass pretty straight while I'm here, knowing that no matter what, our farm can't pick up and move, we're always going to go back.
That's right. Yeah, cool. So did you actually go to school or like get education regarding agriculture, like higher education, or was it just kind of learning from the family business? Or
Essentially, you know, working on a family farm like that, you learn from generations, but I always wanted to bring something back, something to advance. And that's one thing I really enjoy about agriculture is, you know, it's ever changing.
Yeah.
So I did go to the University of Missouri. Unlike our colleague across the way now, Curtis Gregory, I washed out trying to play football at Warrensburg for a year. Realized that, hey, I might not be as good as I thought I was in small town Missouri, and ended up where my parents both went to Mizzou, really valued their agriculture direction and classes, and tried to really bring something home from every class. So it wasn't like, hey, you're going to go home and farm. It was one of those, you're going to go home and farm and try to benefit it in one way or another.
That's cool. I always enjoy like hearing the backstory to how people ended up in this role in Jefferson City as a state representative or senator or whatever. And it's awesome to see the variety of backgrounds of the people that end up here. And that's what you want. I mean, I think as a citizen, I want my representatives to have a wide variety of things they understand, the backgrounds they come from, and what they're working on. And I think that makes for a better lawmaking, environment, actually.
That's the beauty. You know, I tell people back home, we have all walks of life and experts in every field. And it's our job to find those experts, work with those. Hopefully, you know, as a caucus on the Republican side, we find folks, and no doubt there's some on the other side, but we find those folks, we trust those folks, and we stay what I call and tell my people in my lane. And I know my lane, but I'm also good at telling people that lane gets pretty broad, and you know that.
And it's always fun to, you know, kind of figure out that you don't know everything. And there are other people who have better understanding of certain industries and certain backgrounds. And I always love that, just learning about it. So I wanted to dig in a little bit to a bill that you filed again this year. I think we had this last year as well and didn't get all the way across the finish line, I assume, because we're doing it again, working on it again. So we actually just perfected this bill in the House yesterday. So one more vote, right?
One more vote.
Before we send it over to the I call it the dark side of the building.
Yes,
you don't have to comment if you don't want to, but I always call the Missouri Senate the dark side for various reasons, but it's tongue-in-cheek. But This bill is one of those ones that sometimes, you know, we work on a lot of legislation that ends up being almost everything always has, you know, different stakeholders, people that either are in favor or opposed. And we have those hearings and we hear out the people and the public on those issues and vet it. But this one's a little bit controversial for different reasons. And there's a lot of misinformation that's going on about this bill out there. Excuse me. And I wanted to talk about it for that reason. I think there's a lot of issues that we tackle at times where people will try to make an emotional argument for why they don't like the bill or whatever, or why they do like something. And I think that's a dangerous path to go down. Like when it comes to making laws, and I get it, there's a lot of anecdotal stories that people can come up with regarding just about any issue. But I think it's important that we as lawmakers look at the facts, the cold, hard facts, look at research, and look at the real world application of what this is going to look like if this legislation passes. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. You're very well, you know, versed on this topic and understand it, especially being in agriculture and actually that being your livelihood and your business. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. And it's House Bill 544. It updates the Missouri's regulatory framework regarding pesticides, correct?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And that's, I guess, going back to, you know, what the title ultimately is. And I know we're going to dig in on what it actually does. But, yep, that's absolutely
yeah,
right.
So let me just ask you, I'll just go down through and kind of ask you some questions regarding the legislation. And we can talk about that as we go through it. So what, you know, prompted you to introduce this bill? Were there specific issues or gaps in our current regulatory framework when it comes to pesticides? I think it's section 281. I can't remember the rest of the numbers, but it's section 281, I believe, yep, in Missouri statute that already addresses that. So why do we need the update? You know, what prompted you to file this bill?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we look at the agricultural landscape and part of, you know, I believe my whole life and from now on, we have to do a better job of conveying our story. That story, you know, a lot of times comes down to the products we use and what we trust out on the, what I would call on the forefront of agriculture production. And the, you know, we started paying attention. I was in Europe probably 15 years ago, and they started dealing with issues of what I would call removing tools from their toolbox and what they had availability to. And they said, it was on a study abroad with at Mizzou, and they said, you get ready, you know, there's going to be pressure put on the way you guys do things, produce. And I think that accelerated a lot, starting in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
There was a, I'm going to refer to as an alternative study that was done through the International Association of Research on Cancer. Which I love this right now with our time and timing's everything, which is ultimately an arm of the WHO, so the World Health Organization.
Yes, that's an important thing to point out, and I wanted to bring up as well, because they are under fire for a lot of reasons when it comes to really not being objective about what they claim their whole purpose is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, mission statement, purpose.
COVID definitely brought that out, yep, with the WHO. And I believe President Trump has completely defunded the WHO and said we're not sending our tax dollars to this
defunded,
organization.
Defunded, disassociated.
We don't want anything to do with
it. I'm in believance of that 100%.
Yeah. Okay, so sorry, get back to your study.
Then. No, so, you know, a study comes out criticizing a tool that a lot of people, and we're going to go down to the base level of this bill, you know, a tool that we have available, and it's used on a lot of farms across not only Missouri but the United States, and that involved glyphosate. So we look at that more from an industry standpoint of glyphosate. Maybe this organization, IARC, as we're going to refer to for simplicity, said, well, maybe there's they looked at all the studies, and lots of research had been done on this product, and that's one thing that I'm proud of in this whole process. I believe that the United States does have this right. Now, we can argue about other processes, but, you know, the process to get a product out to the farmers in the United States is very vigorous. We have to depend on, you know, larger partners in the industry that are making sure doing the research, working through all these different avenues of testing, analysts, and spending the money to get it to us.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a study that came out that put one of those main products that we use, and specific to what a lot of the talks on this bill has been about, is Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
Trade name Roundup. Underlying chemical is glyphosate. And when that started happening, that study was able to be used in litigation against this. Predominantly at that point in time, it was Monsanto. It has changed to Bayer, which are trigger words, you know.
Yeah.
As we're talking about controversy, kind of trigger words. But it ultimately changed the landscape of what their business model looked like and what all the research and look, ultimately research from multiple people, multiple organizations, multiple universities, and to the tune of 50 years, they're able to litigate against this company and this product. And to me, from the standpoint of knowing how we do things, how many things we depend on in our arsenal of a program, truly a ag chemical program. And, you know, one thing that I really like to emphasize, and I've had this talk with various sides in the building, is we're very specific on how much we use, how much we can use, how much full season uses there are. So when that study came
out, that's already currently regulated a lot then.
Yeah. And even from the standpoint, and this is right now, right here, this was handed down also, the requirements for having an applicator license in Missouri, not only private, commercial. You know, we're under very stringent regulations of understanding the product, how much we can use, and where it can be used on. So from that standpoint, this, I'm going to speed this up for you. That litigation started questioning some of the products we had and allowed an industry outside of here to start really throwing darts and changing a business model through advertising, through cases that really, really put some of the products we had in jeopardy.
So trial attorneys.
Yep. Trial, you know, trial.
Class action lawsuits.
Class action lawsuits, that whole process. And it really accelerated. There was one case that was decided, and ultimately, I know we've had this conversation, and cancer gets pretty broad, but the only association that this product and glyphosate, they really have honed in on that they believe the other side associates with is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Mm-hmm.
So those lawsuits started happening. As a business owner, business model, you know, you got to mitigate risk. You start working because, you know, you've got 50 years of data. You put yourself through a process. You've got over 800 studies, private, independent, along with, you know, I'll acknowledge everybody wants to be mad at the company for submitting data or submitting studies. Rightfully so. They've put that investment in. They probably know it better. But, you know, from the regulatory side, federal-wise, not only the EPA, EPA now, but the USDA, whenever you look at that side of things and who gets to analyze those products, they're reactionary.
Yeah.
You know, if
right.
multiple different studies come in criticizing, including IARC, criticizing this product, saying, hey, maybe it could be a carcinogen or cancer-based, then they're going to reanalyze, they're going to authorize different organizations to look at that, which is really going back to why I trust this process. But after that study, it started critically making some of us worry about, does this change a business model enough where we don't have availability to sell these products? And to me, the sustainability piece of making sure we know, as a company, you know, we'll be transparent. This company is multinational, but it has a base here, and you know, the North American base is in Missouri.
Yeah,
they're
Missouri based.
They're mining products here. They're manufacturing. You know, they're ultimately formulating. They're shipping and distributing all right here. And whenever they start facing enough litigation that they might have to change their business model and how we out there on the forefront of agriculture get those products, that's whenever I decide, I'm like, hey, this is a problem that needs to be analyzed, viewed, and from the standpoint of what's next.
Right.
You know, I really think of this bill whenever I dive into it, what if there are some alternative studies out there? Maybe a few, maybe it's a percentage. It goes against overwhelming amount of evidence that say it is safe. And it doesn't have to be. That's why I'm like, this isn't product specific. But down the road, if it's something else that we have in our toolbox that they start to get litigated against and it starts changing the landscape of how we do things, that to me is when I said, we got to start making some changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to get into some other, I think, real world consequences of that too, that I think are very concerning. Let me ask you this. I mean, farmers, do they typically support the bill? Is it something that they can, because a lot of the time they're using this product more than anybody when it comes to agriculture. So where do they stand in this fight?
You know, and that's one thing that I think I really value about our legislative process up here. It allows multiple fronts for people to weigh in, two sides, you know, both chambers across the building. And I'm just going to take it back base level to committee. You know, we had ag groups, we had scientists, we had people there not associated with anything to do with bear coming from universities. We had people driving in from out of state that wanted to highlight the importance of this product that we're specifically talking about. You know, I think that it's something that weeds are great out on the farm of changing, you know, and adapting and wanting to live. And this product back in the day, it revolutionized the landscape. It really changed of, you know, taking iron out. My grandpa, you know, we talked about the days of plowing and taking iron out, and that was really your only alternative to getting rid of weeds. Mm-hmm. This, you know, when we're looking at, you know, the amount we use and what we're able to target and making sure at the end of the day that our farmers have a chance to guarantee profit, this product absolutely changed the landscape, and we hope there's more to come.
Right.
You know, which is why codifying or promoting this process, we hope that there's more products to come and that we can have, you know, faith in, and knowing the amount of time and how fast we've seen the weed, genealogy side change. We want to make sure that those products can continue to be there. But this is we're looking at planting acreage-wise probably 90 million acres of corn and soybeans, and it's used on 85% of farms.
Yeah.
And over time, when it came out in 1974, is relatively new, really got traded in the 90s. And, you know, over time, there's no doubt there's direct grass. You know, usage has gone up. I'm confident in the data I've seen of non-Hodgkin staying the same, mm-hmm. and the agriculture sector of being the largest user of this product, but the least amount of cases. There's a little bit of relativity there that didn't match up. So I think that, you know, uses have gone up, dependence and you know, the adaptation of using this product has sure gone up. And we look at levels that this product really concerned of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma staying the same.
Yeah. So if you were to just summarize, like, mechanically what the bill does and what it changes, like, within the current regulatory framework, what would that be, just in a few words as you could summarize it?
Yeah. And, you know, outside this building, it's how you interact. And, you know, I've had some of those battles. But ultimately, this process that we know the chemicals have to go through has been around since 1947, the FIFRA Act, Fungicide, Insecticide, Rodenticide Act, took place in 1947. Now, I was corrected and I learned it was initially under the United States Department of Ag. Mm-hmm. It went in later on to be under the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. So this process has been around a long time. And, you know, during the bill and working on both sides, I think it's good to understand both sides. There's often points brought up as, well, they've got it wrong before. And that's absolutely right. You know, there's been products out there that have been bad. And, you know, after reanalyzing or data or, you know, talking, there becomes problems. They're removed from the market.
Mm-hmm.
But we look at 50 years of data, no real scientific evidence from a regulatory side that has shown that this product is cancerous.
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at the facts that what they are getting litigated against. Right. And the Cole County case here, they Bayer lost all three cases, or all three causes of action: negligence, product defect, and failure to warn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're really focused on the bill is codifying that process, saying the FIFRA Act and the regulatory side of what these products have to go through is the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the best process we feel to really analyze the product, get it to us. We feel like that's the golden rule. And if they've gone through that process, all the data, all the, you know, analysts of multiple agencies and organizations say, hey, we can't associate with this with cancer or anything, you know, bad going on in the human body, and they fulfilled their duty to warn, which is one of those aspects when we talk about litigation.
Yeah, and I think, too, if I remember right, they may have won, like, the majority of their cases, though, when they have been sued. And it basically comes down to what the courts will allow as evidence. Like, when they allow the body of evidence that's out there, they usually these companies win their cases.
Right? Yeah, and I was trying not to be too factual on the floor, but we're looking at over 50 or 60% of the last 20, and there's 50,000 sitting here in Missouri right now. You know, they're advertising. If you don't think that changes the business model, I don't know what to say. You know, ultimately to the point of, hey, we try 50,000. If we get, you know, 5% of that, that's
a ton of money,
large amount. So we look at that, and what that ultimately means to me. It's something that is very detrimental.
It is, and it's concerning. So let's talk about this real quick on the labeling requirements. You know, that's a big part of the bill. Do you see this as like reducing regulatory burden for the manufacturer, and then by that, the people who buy the products as well, the farmers who use it? I look at this as a small government bill, not growing government.
I think that's absolutely right. And we look at what our state departments are capable of. You know, what are our state departments capable of? And is it, you know, ultimately reanalyzing and going through a whole new process, you know, from the state side? Or is it saying, hey, this process has been very rigorous. We know it's been going on for a long time. Is this what we accept? And ultimately, the FIFRA Act dictates that. It does. You know, we've had some talks. The argument is a lot of times like we're giving up our state sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And it's been gone. You know, if you read the FIFRA Act, it's been gone. And that's to start with that argument, I'm like, if this was truly changing the act or trying to, you know, direct the federal government, this has been a federal government rule of law since 1947. Right. So I kind of moved past that argument very fast. But I ultimately go back to this is less, you know, I don't know how we would facilitate it. Currently, you know, our Department of Ag, I want to brag on them for a minute. You know, we're self-funded, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, you know, I think they do a good and efficient job. But how do they have those tools? And is that even more darts for someone else to throw at if they don't have those tools, you know, to put out a good product? So, yeah, I think the limited government and also being respectful of what I know it takes a private company. So I can only imagine, you know, government wise. And I know that we've got some people in DC looking at efficiency of government.
Right.
But if it takes a company $300 million of private money to get a product through the whole regulatory process, what's the government spending on that? You know? So
we probably don't know, actually.
Could we find out?
Apparently, it looks like that Elon Musk and those that are working on those things are finding that out very quickly.
That's right.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, real world potential consequences if we can't get this bill passed and signed into law. You know, what are some of your concerns? I'm going to give you a few of mine real quick.
I'd love to hear that.
You can talk about it as well. But when you, again, when you look at the facts, when you look at the research on this topic, I have some real concerns. And here's a few. I'm concerned about our food security in this country, like just nationally right now. You know, being that Missouri is vital because we're such a huge state when it comes to agriculture, we affect the food security of our entire country. This state does, not just our own state. And so it's vital to our food supply, the ability for our agricultural crops to be able to be grown at the level that they are grown at. And produce that level of food, and I think it's really important for our food supply nationally. And I have concerns about this. China, it seems to me, has been really pushing their way into almost near dominance, really, when it comes to their input in our ag systems, and in so many different ways too. You know, it's not just about them buying up farmland, which they're doing. Yep. And we've actually had bills addressing that. I have one,
yeah.
You know, talking about foreign ownership of land. I think it's a concern.
Yep.
It's a huge concern. It's not just China. They're the worst actor in this for sure. And you know, the proof is out there, but also machinery, like they're into agricultural machinery big time.
Yep.
They're into pesticides.
You know,
what we're talking about, these chemicals. You know, so here's a question that I have that I think is a really pertinent question to ask when it comes to our food security and food supply. What kind of crop losses could we potentially expect, you know, if these crop protection products were not available, if that availability goes down significantly, I mean, really even insignificant, if it goes down at all, What could we see when it comes to crop loss in that?
Yeah, I'm going to dive into that on two parts. You know, we talked about the supply. The supply of products and availability. You and I talked earlier. I don't know if it's estimated the generic market. When we say generic, it's a chemical we have available to us. But on the generic side, it might be cheaper, and a lot of them are coming out of China. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did we talk 40%? Is that about where generic?
I think the phosphate chemical is about 40%. Okay. That China produces. And there's another one, let me look if I put it in my notes, nitrogen. So nitrogen, I think about 28% of the world's nitrogen is produced in China.
Yeah, so when we
Are really essential to crop
growth. They are. Growth. And whenever we look about availability and making sure we have those products available, you know, when we're thinking about crop year 2025, a lot of our inputs have been secure and made sure that, hey, whenever we sign that check, and where I'm from, we still have checks, you know that. When we sign that check, prepaying some chemical, fertilizer, seed, that when we sign that, it's going to show up to us. And that's one thing, you know, about a company like this, knowing that all the whole process is done here, and us guaranteeing it gets to us, that's very important. Number, you know, if they change their business model, and we've had arguments about this with people, well, they're not going to change it. They're going to still continue to sell it. But at some point, if they change their business model and said, hey, we're going to sell it everywhere else, we're not getting litigated against, which this seems to be the only country in the world.
Yeah.
If they change that process and we start relying on, we talked about those amounts earlier. And, you know, we can bring it down to more elementary level, you know, per acre, we're probably, running a 12 ounce per application. So that's not very much, but you think about that amount of acres, mm-hmm. that's a lot of product flowing in.
Yeah.
Not only talking about logistics, but just somebody having the ability to influence markets.
And how often do you use it per acre?
Yeah. So going back to that label, there's a max amount you can use per acre.
Okay.
I mean, it's crop specific. Usually on a corn, I like a single pass program, like once that corn's growing, which leads more into some more of the misconception. A lot of the commercial acres or what we're farming out there goes, a lot of it goes to your district. A lot of my corn goes for feed.
Yep.
Some of it goes for fuel. And ultimately fiber also. So, you know, a lot of what we're raising, I've had conversations here of, you know, concerns and plants and food supply. And, you know, a lot of it is, hey.
Yeah, I've heard people, you're poisoning the plants. You're poisoning our food.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, that's, you know, if it is used as before the plant was ever there, because if it's contacted with it, it's going to kill it.
Yep.
So a lot of that, what I've been working on my time up here is making sure they understand the full process. And whenever I take, you know, corn down to Neosho, to the mills, you know, it's ground to a powder, and it's a GMO corn base, but it allows us to use these products. Yeah. So if we switch that motive of having to rely on another country, making sure it shows up, and then having, you know, we have competitive markets. We have a United States product. We have generics coming in, and I feel like, you know, open market, free market, it keeps a pretty good balance. If we only have one source, I can about guarantee you what's going to happen to price-wise to our producers who already have.
That's another part of it is the fiscal part of this and products going up, which means it's going to get transferred to the consumer who goes and buys their food, right?
Yep.
So, again, more higher food prices could be a result as well if this is something that isn't addressed. Real quick, one other thing I wanted to ask too is, you know, so we've talked about a company that's actually based out of Missouri. They have, they're producing this, manufacturing this here. If you regulate these companies out of business, which is a actual concern, right?
Yep.
If the trial attorneys keep going after these businesses, they have to look at their bottom line. They have to look at all of those things because it's a business, right? They have to make a profit. And if that changes, and this goes away, then you're reliant upon foreign countries and mainly China for those products. And I think that's a very big concern for me, and I think it should be for most Americans and most Missourians because I guarantee you it's not going to be regulated in China like it is here.
No.
And the level of safety and the level of checks and balances that is put in place for that process. So I think it's important to take all of that into consideration and look at the facts, you know, look at this from a perspective like yours. You know, you're a person that uses this product. You're a person that grows this food and sees that to, you know, the next step of where that food goes and those products. And, you know, it's important to look at that, not just an emotional look at, you know, what people are saying online, because, you know, as you well know, that could be some crazy nefarious motivations at times, right? Because there's different people that behind the scenes have a stake in this one way or the other. And I think it's just important to look at the facts. And so that's what I wanted to do with this. I really appreciate digging into this. I think it's really going to help people to understand this issue better. And if there's anything you'd like to just sign off with on this topic, let it fly.
Yeah, first of all, it's a pleasure. We'll have to come back and we'll talk some hunting and sure. You know, some other real world great stuff that we're doing as a caucus here in Jefferson City. But you know, ultimately, come back to me on the argument of, you know, whether you think glyphosate's effective or ineffective. This bill's not going to do anything to change that.
Yeah.
The product's still going to be used. If for some reason tomorrow that changes federal wise, that's handed down to us. You know, if for some reason studies, or, you know, at the respect of President Trump, if they change our policy and what's available to us, that changes for us tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we really think that process, is the gold standard. Yeah. We want to make sure that, to me, that we can produce, and I think we're the best in the world. I think that a lot of people look to us, and we're the best at producing crops in the world and making sure our people are fed. And so we're so good at that we export a lot of crops because we, you know, we quite honestly do a great job at it. But at the end of the day, it's a process we trust. We think the overwhelming amount of work that goes into getting a label, getting a product through the process, making sure it's available to our producers, is sufficient enough to make sure they've met all the demands. The science in this aspect is on our side. It makes sure that those products have a little bit of sustainability and a little bit of what I would say, a little bit of a platform to stand on, saying that, hey, there's nothing out there that we can use our resources. Now, anybody can put anything together, but we can use our resources, and we can't say that this is problematic and that our producers are still going to be able to use it. So to me, at the end of the day, I'm a believer in the process. I want to make sure the farmers have those tools and that we can protect it long into the future, and it gives stability to continue to invest in research in our market.
Awesome. I really do appreciate you taking the time to dig into this with me, and I think it will help our listeners to understand this better as well. So you heard it right here.
You know,
the real deal.
I've listened many times, you know, over the journey, and I'm always respectful of that. But you know, even in the tractor cab, you know, so I always enjoy it. I appreciate being on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this subject.
Yeah.
I'm always open to anybody and hearing both sides.
Always.
So I sure appreciate it.
It makes for better lawmaking, I think. So, awesome. I appreciate you coming on, Dane, and taking the time to do this. And y'all know what to do. You know where to find us. Anywhere you get your podcasts, Amazon, we're on Spotify. We're also on Apple Podcasts. Look up the Man Cave Caucus podcast. And with that, hey, we'll catch you on the weekend episode. Have a good day, everybody.